Okay, good afternoon. So at the end of next week, I will lead a high-level business mission and culture delegation on an official visit to China. This trip will celebrate the 40th anniversary of diplomatic relations between our two countries and the 5th anniversary of the China-New Zealand FTA. This will be one of the largest ever delegations to travel with offshore with the New Zealand Prime Minister. We will visit three Chinese cities, Guangzhou, Shanghai and Beijing. I'll meet with the new President of China, President Xi, at the Boao Forum on Sunday the 7th of April, which is the 5th anniversary to the day of the signing of the FTA. This is still China's only such agreement with a developed country. New Zealand exports to China have more than tripled since the signing of the Free Trade Agreement, and trade has grown for both partners. Last year, New Zealand's exports to China totaled just under $7 billion, which is up more than 16% on the previous year. Two-way trade was touch under $15 billion, $14.6 billion. The potential for even more growth is huge, which will deliver benefits both to the New Zealand economy, and this trip will be about driving that growth. China is now New Zealand's second largest and fastest growing major trading and tourism partner. It's also our largest education market for foreign students. Last year, nearly 200,000 Chinese visitors came to New Zealand, up 35% on the previous year, and they spent around about $651 million in New Zealand. Last Friday's figures released by Tourism New Zealand showed Chinese visitor numbers for the month of February were up by more than 100% on the previous year, making the biggest ever February for international arrivals. I'll also be officially welcomed by China's new Premier, Premier Li, at the Great Hall of the People in Beijing, which will meet several senior regional and city leaders in the major centres of Guangzhou and Shanghai. The visit is an opportunity to support New Zealand companies in China through business support activities and major tourism and education promotional events being held in the three cities we are visiting. Foreign Affairs Minister Murray McCulley will also travel to Boao with me. Economic Development Minister Stephen Joyce, Trade Minister Tim Grosser and Māori Affairs Minister Peter Sharples will accompany the business mission. Cochrane delegation will be away from the 6th of April to the 13th of April. Just in terms of the House this week, the government intends to progress the Student Loan Amendment Bill number 2 and the Social Services Benefit Categories and Work Focus Amendment Bill. In terms of my activity, I'll be here obviously today, tomorrow and Wednesday, Thursday, and Christchurch. Friday is obviously Easter weekend.
From the issue of jobs, are you confident that the economy is in fact creating more jobs than it's losing? We're obviously seeing a lot of high profile job losses at the moment.
Well, we certainly are seeing plenty of jobs being advertised online. We're seeing our benefit numbers falling, and the quarterly employment survey tells us that we've created about 64,000 jobs in the last couple of years. So yes, I mean, of course, where there are job losses, some of them very high profile, or potential job losses, as has been discussed with Telecom, but you know, there are many activities that I go to in any given week where we are also going to businesses that are in the process of creating jobs and looking for new staff.
Are you creating more full-time jobs than you're losing?
Yeah, so the issue's been full-time job creation's been very positive. The issue's been around part-time jobs, and we're likely to see more of that as the construction and retail sectors pick up.
Are you concerned about the impact these proposed job losses
at Dock could have? Well, again, as I'm prone to saying, I always worry when someone loses their job, of course. But there are at least steps afoot to try and do the best they can for the people at Dock. That announcement will be made tomorrow, so we'll just leave that for Al Morrison to work through those details.
Sounds like it will be frontline staff, though, and that could have a huge impact.
It would be better to wait until tomorrow before we jump to any conclusions.
The unemployment rate's at 6.9%. Yep. Does your government, though, not accept some responsibility for that being too high?
Oh, look, we would argue that, obviously, by definition, a lower unemployment number is better, and we're working very hard to do achieve that. I mean, all we can do is put in place the conditions which encourage businesses to take on workers. So that is managing interest rates as best we can through our own activities, making sure that we're building infrastructure, making sure that the tax regime is there to support that activity, making sure the planning laws and all of those things are conducive to investment. We can't force an employer to take someone on, and even if we had make work schemes, they would be small in comparison to the 2.2 million jobs in the economy.
How long do you expect to lag for, though? Because if people say, we've got a jobless recovery, it's going to take another 6 months or whatever before that job market catches up with the growth you are seeing.
Well, I think the first thing is worth noting, we still have a lower unemployment rate from memory than the average in the OECD, except it's higher than some other countries, but certainly lower than others. Secondly, I think we can take from what we saw in terms of Q4 growth in 2012, that plus 1.5% number, some confidence, as we can take the confidence in the business surveys that we're seeing, consumer confidence, business confidence numbers up. So look, these things will take a bit of time. Employment typically does lag, and you've seen it in quite a lot of developed countries, the United States in particular, where there's been, somewhat of a jobless, recovery. But, I look at New Zealand and I see Christchurch, where there's a huge amount of demand and massive amount of work looking to take place. Some of the skill shortages we're now seeing reported, we're seeing it fall in our benefit numbers week after week. So that's an indication people are going off a benefit into work. And you are starting to see, consumer confidence coming back. So people are spending money, that's good for retail. So look, you've got to give it a bit of time, but I think the projections we're still seeing are that unemployment will track nearer towards 6% by the end of the year, and hopefully something with a 5 in front of it for 2014.
So what do you say to those people who are caught in the middle here, who are missing out on jobs, who are caught in that lag? Sorry, three on net.
Well, all you can do is say, look, judge the government by what it's doing, or maybe, to take the counter argument, you can also, throw criticism as if you see things that we're not doing. But, in terms of trying to stimulate jobs, we've done a lot of things on that front. I mean, we've done everything from 90-day probationary periods to starting out wages, stripping away business compliance costs, lowering tax on the business community. There's been a low interest rate environment. We're throwing billions of dollars at Christchurch. We've been enabling a faster recovery than would otherwise take place. So, that's what's within the control of the government. And, as I said, I think we are seeing improvement. We've got to be careful we don't talk ourselves down, because there's genuine improvement taking place in the economy. There's a lot more optimism out there this year than there was last year.
The Reserve Bank and Treasury are tomorrow having a conference on exchange rate policy. Do you think that they should be discussing a change, or is there room for a change?
Well, I think the IMF pointed out that monetary policy is broadly in the right place, and in fact that New Zealand shouldn't, even though it's experiencing an overvalued exchange rate, be prone to knee-jerk reactions. I would support the view of the IMF. I mean, we've always said, look, if there are better ways of doing things, present them to us. But over the years, there's been a number of studies, and none of them have come up with anything terribly dramatic.
Prime Minister, the OBR, in relation further to Bernard's question, the OBR regime that the Reserve Bank is putting in place is very similar to the arrangement which ECB is attempting to try and use in Cyprus at the moment. Are you concerned, or do you, now that we've seen this mechanism in process, are you at all concerned about policy development in that area?
No. I mean, look, I think it's worth taking a step back and saying, well, what is the Reserve Bank trying to do here with open bank resolution? The first thing is to say there are three real options on the table. One is depositors have their deposits insured, and if we go down that path, every consumer has to pay for that. Because the banks won't pay for it, they're not going to cut their margins, so they'll have to pass that on to consumers. The second option is that there is no protection at all, in which case if there's a major financial collapse, they'll have to rely on the government of the day to either act or not act, but there's no real guarantee. Third option with open bank resolution is one that says, well, look, yep, there could be a haircut, but you can immediately get access to the balance of your funds, and a new bank effectively starts up that's government guaranteed. I actually think that potentially puts New Zealand depositors in the strongest position possible at the lowest cost of them, because we are talking about something that would be very extreme.
But the Australians are keeping a $250,000 deposit insurance.
They do.
Wouldn't New Zealanders just jump across the Tasman?
Well, not necessarily, because if their money is in what is essentially a New Zealand banking entity, no. Even if it is a full subsidiary of Westpac Australia or whatever, it's still a New Zealand bank. So yes, they could take their money out, but without OBR they can't get their money out potentially. That's the risk, isn't it?
So what's to stop people who had their money frozen or saw other people have their money frozen in one bank saying, right, I'm getting my money out of the other three?
They could do, but again, that's the confidence that I would have thought that you get from OBR, which is you know that you don't have to spend 5 years in court back wing it out. I mean, I think in the end of the day, you're talking about very extreme positions. You're not talking about run-of-the-mill normal activity. You're talking about the collapse of a major financial institution. And if that day ever comes to New Zealand, well, the government of the day will have to think about how it handles it. OBR gives it one tool in the toolbox to deal with it. It's not the only way. The government could choose to step in and completely recapitalise and start again. It doesn't have to go through the OBR route. But without that option, it has very few options on the table. And as we're seeing in these countries like Cyprus, the reason these things are happening is because the governments themselves have got themselves into a position where they're fundamentally broke.
So why shouldn't New Zealand use a deposit insurance scheme or just about every other OECD country in Australia?
You can do, but you've got to pay for it. So insurance isn't free.
How many basis points do you think it would be?
Don't know, but I mean, it would be a cost to every consumer.
But we currently have fairly high interest rates by global standards. If we just built that into the cost of credit in New Zealand, that wouldn't necessarily have that much of an impact on consumers.
Still be a cost to the consumer. So that's your choice, isn't it? I mean, the simple choice is to say, I'll take deposit insurance and I'll pay for that. And we saw that when the old deposit guarantee scheme was rushed through before the 2008 election, it was decided that for consumers that actually wouldn't be a cost, and for small financial institutions, but actually the big banks did pay for it, and eventually that cost has to be passed on. Well, obviously it's distressing that you see privacy breach of that nature. On the other side of the coin, I mean, I think EQC at least acted very quickly in the sense that within 40 minutes it got out there, as I understand it, contacted the person in receipt of that information, sought a statutory declaration that the information had been destroyed. So, you know, look, we do live in a world where these things are possible. The government agencies and departments are looking at lots of ways to try and tighten that up so it doesn't happen again. But all of us, you know, probably in our lives have seen an email by mistake or a text message by mistake. It does happen. So we've just got to keep working on trying to improve those systems. But obviously it's very disappointing that it's happened.
Not necessarily with that kind of degree of detail that always slip off an accidental email. What needs to be done across
government? I don't know. I've had a few sent to me that probably shouldn't have been sent to me. But anyway, look, in the end, I mean, I'm sure EQC have gone away to re-examine how it actually took place and how they can ensure it doesn't happen again. I know ACC have been working through that process very carefully in recent times.
But how can you give people that assurance?
Sorry?
How can you give the people that assurance across government departments?
Well, all I can say is that for the sheer volume of information that's dealt with, the number of breaches, you know, are relatively small or decreasing. Certainly ACC had some real issues, but in recent times they've implemented new systems. I think there's been one breach this year that's been, you know, very, very small number. EQC have been dealing with huge amounts of information and hundreds of thousands of client contacts over the last few years, and they've had one breach. Now, it's one too many, but I don't think we're going to blow that out of proportion.
So, Minister, are you comparing this privacy leak to somebody accidentally sending an email?
Well, my understanding was it was accidental. I might be wrong, but it's the details I have.
But it's 9,000 people.
Well, I think it's more than that, actually.
Well, everyone who made a claim.
Yeah, but it was one file sent to one person.
What do you make of the fact that the recipients showed other people, perhaps including Leanne Dalzell?
Well, look, I don't know the details of the person that received it. All I know is that an assurance was sought that the information would be destroyed. That assurance was given, and a statutory declaration has been signed. So, you know, one hopes that will be honoured.
It seems they may have reached that, though.
Well, I can't say for sure that they have or they haven't. I don't know.
So you don't know who the recipient is?
I don't know. Sure, so no. I haven't asked that question.
Prime Minister, just on solid energy, were you or any of your ministers consulted, or did you have discussions with solid energy about body recovery or the purchase of Pike River?
Look, I'd have to go back and check all of our files, so I don't have those to hand, but at the time that the purchase of Pike River was being mooted by Solid Energy, from the best of my memory, there was quite a bit of discussion about what our expectations would be in terms of body recovery in the event that they could get into the main workings of the mine. And I think they have been fairly laid out in the purchase document that they signed and agreed. And essentially that's the basis that's led to you know, potentially a plan to go up the drift.
And was the purchase driven by any considerations in terms of your pledge to recover the bodies, or would you describe it as more of a completely commercial kind of transaction?
Well, I guess it was fair to say we thought that Solid Energy, who were operating obviously with Spring Creek down the road, one, understood that environment, and so if they could operate in Spring Creek, they probably had the best chance of at least understanding how to operate in Pike River. Secondly, they had, and I think do have, a very strong working relationship on the West Coast, so they would have been sensitive to the families. And thirdly, commercially, there's a big resource potentially there. And as you can see, if you read the scoping study, one of the concerns was the low level of proven reserves that Solid Energy had. So I think it sort of met two objectives. One was it would increase potentially their proven reserves, and secondly, they were probably our best chance for getting in the mine and undertaking body recovery if that was at all possible.
So were they encouraged to find Pike River by ministers?
They weren't discouraged from taking it. It was, from the best of my recollection, their idea. Vaguely remember them sort of raising the issue with us. They weren't a buyer at any price. I don't know whether the paperwork shows this or not, I'm pretty sure it probably does, but they had a couple of thoughts about whether they would or wouldn't get involved. But when all of the other bidders pulled out, then it was fairly obvious they could get it at a very, very low price, and that was the point at which they stepped in.
Prime Minister, the draft plan in Auckland, the Employers and Manufacturers Association says the government should give a tick for an October start for the draft plan.
I am confident that we can make good progress and assist Auckland, and that's why we're speeding up the adoption of the unitary plan. But I think it's really important that we also reserve the right for people to have some input. And that's what the hearings panel is all about. And normally, I've got to say, we are criticised for wanting to speed up that process and not giving people the ability to have input. And you can't help but wonder that if we were making the case that we should be adopting this in day one with no consultation of any great magnitude, people would be screaming at us that we were not respectful for the bureau, for the democratic process, and that we were being too hasty. So I think my view is we've got that about right. But, I mean, Nick Smith is meeting with Paula Bennett, with Len Brown tonight, and they'll continue to work on how we can advance, the objectives of both the council and the government, which in my view are very closely aligned.
Do you think private sector builders can build those 400,000 dwellings in the next 30 years?
Well, they're the only people that can. I think we're a bit misguided if we think the government can. I mean, those days of the Ministry of Works are gone. So we don't build our own schools today, let alone build residential houses.
Do you still have a Labour sector scrap its policy, its GST policy on helping food share has been quite vague? Should leaders come forward and say what
the
policies are?
Yeah, and I mean, look, to be perfectly honest, we're nearly into April, and the only things that we can work out about the Labour Party this year are that they've abandoned their vision for being able to build houses for $300,000, and now they're abandoning their flagship policy in the 2011 election of GST of fruit and vegetables. I mean, it's a dog of a policy, it doesn't work, and it wouldn't have actually delivered any benefits to consumers, they probably know that. But David Sherridge should just come out and say that. When he's said that, it'd be interesting to hear what he actually wants to do, because at the moment, he's pretty much in reverse mode, he's certainly not going
forward. Prime Minister. This is the third policy that's reneged on from the 2011 policy platform. What does that say about
Well, I think it just shows you that they actually didn't really believe in what they were campaigning on. Certainly the new leadership doesn't. And I mean, at the end of the day, parties change their policy, fair enough. But we'd be interested in what they're going to do, and at the moment we don't hear any of that from Labor.
Prime Minister, the Operation Day Boom has been, we've now seen inside it a lot more clearly now. Presumably you have asked for briefings about it or read some of this material that's been released. Are you familiar are you now with what took place in February last year?
Well, I wouldn't say I've read that much.
So in February last year, we now know that there was this meeting between the senior intelligence analysts where...
Can I just interrupt you?
Yeah.
I don't intend to make any comment on it. It's before the courts, and we'll just leave it at that.
So are you saying...
Stand by what I said. I'm not going to make any comments.
So can I just clarify that? So is that going to be a position of the House, of the government, in relation to this case, sort of like blanket, that you're not going to comment either in the House or to the media about...
Well, my comment is that it's before the courts. The matter's before the courts. These are court documents, and I don't think it'd be very advisable for me to wade in on.
You're the minister in charge of the GCSB, though. We've now obviously had a series of disclosures about your department. You have a new CEO in place. How confident are you that the issues that are raised in this case have been addressed adequately?
Well, in the fullness of time, you're about to see the work program we're undertaking.
So you have been briefed on this. I mean, I think that you can say whether or not you've been briefed or that you are in charge of this. I mean, you're the minister in charge of the GCSB, I understand. So can we take it that you are appraised of the issues that are being raised here and you are addressing them?
Well, as I say, in the fullness of time, you'll see the work program.
Have you been briefed on the job cuts proposal that document?
Oh, I need a very high level.
Have you sought assurance, or are you confident that it won't erode our green credentials to the point where it might affect tourism, as some have suggested?
Well, I don't believe it will, and you'll need to see the announcement tomorrow and draw your own assessment.
What are you confident about eroding our green credentials to the extent of actually affecting our threatened species?
No, I don't believe it will.
Are you confident there won't be frontline job cuts?
I don't believe they will be largely characterised as that, no.
What maybe do you mean by largely?
Well, there may be one or two people that would argue a case there, but my understanding is that's not the right classification.
Well, how does DOC keep up the work on reducing budget then?
Yeah, so you have to wait and see tomorrow what they're actually doing.
Do you still have confidence in the CEO of EQC?
Yes. Look, again, you know, it's a disappointing mistake. These things shouldn't happen, but from time to time they do. They'll need to go away and absolutely assess exactly how they made that mistake. But, you know, this is an organisation dealing with a huge number of interactions with Cantabrians, and it's possible for a staff member to make a mistake. My understanding is it was literally that, a genuine mistake.
Is an independent review necessary?
I wouldn't have thought so, but one issue. I mean, I know it's a very large file, but I don't think there's a case that there's a systemic problem there.
Jerry Brownlee says whatever legal action to discover who passes information on or who receives information, if they have passed it on, will be taken. Do you think that's necessary?
Well, again, that's a matter for others to really, you know, go through. I mean, my concern is making sure that we identify how the error took place and that we don't repeat it. I mean, in the end, if an error has happened, it's happened, and we've just got to deal with that. If someone wants to pass information on, well, beyond the point of signing a statutory declaration that they've destroyed that data, we hope they would honour that. They would have legal obligations to do so.
Can I just clarify about that review? In the release, it says an independent review will advise EQC on how to make sure that's achieved as quickly as possible. So will an independent... That's from Jerry Brown.
I haven't been advised that they may do that.
When will the government confirm that signed United Nations climate change reduction target?
Don't know exactly when. I mean, Cabinet hasn't discussed that issue yet, but we've made a commitment that we'll be releasing our binding target in 2013, so I can't exactly tell you when, but it'll be sometime this year.
What's taking so long?
There's a lot of different things going on. I mean, we're doing our budget at the moment, and that's a much more pressing concern than this.
Is it likely to be that 10-20% provisional target likely to be scaled?
I wouldn't want to give you an indication of what that's likely to be.
But that was the advice that Rosa gave you last year,
Cabinet. I haven't seen any updated advice, and I want to see that.
In your budget preparations at the moment, you said this is what you're focused on.
Yep.
What are the main things you're thinking about looking at?
Nice try, but we won't go there today, are they? We'll give it a little bit longer.
In your trip to China,
yep.
What are you hoping to achieve?
Well, I mean, in China, you know, they're our second largest market. They've got, you know, arguably one day the potential to be our largest market. So the question is, how do we build even deeper penetration into the Chinese market? How do we see more students, more tourists, more exports going to China and more students and tourists coming over here? How do we build greater investment opportunities into each other's market? And, you know, I think we've made enormous progress in 5 years of an FTA and 40 years of diplomatic relations, but yeah, if you look at the sheer scale and development of China, I don't think have got anywhere near reaching the ceiling of our economic opportunities for them.
Are you concerned that China, which is having some tensions with Japan, might object to Japan joining the free trade agreement, or New Zealand being part of that?
Well, they may or may not hold private views on what they think of China potentially joining TPP, but the reality is, Japan joining TPP, but the reality is China's not a participant in TPP, so it doesn't actually get a voice there to exercise its view.
Thank you.
What's the idea of Japan joining the TPP? From memory after Vladivostok, you were characterising it as difficult, and there were concerns among officials that it may undermine the purity of the deal.
Yeah, so I would say if they're prepared to join on the same conditions as everybody else, in other words, the current 11 members, then it would be a very good thing that they're joining, because they are a huge economy. We don't have an FTA with them, and they are really important. But if they were prepared to accept a high-quality, comprehensive deal, or if they were going to take a very long time to achieve that, I would see that as a negative move. But now, one hopes that they are in the former position of the latter.
But doesn't it make it more attractive to the United States, for instance, to delay and maybe make compromises in order to get Japan in, given it's such a big economy, and that may end up to our detriment?
Well, everyone has to balance off the risks and the opportunities. The opportunities, as I've just said, are very clear. The risks are that it slows the process down or weakens the quality of the deal. I don't think President Obama would actually support them going into TPP unless he was confident that the deal could be concluded on broadly the same timescale as he has been talking about and of a high-quality nature. Certainly that's the discussions that I've held with President Obama on the issue have always been one of him expressing a clear desire to see a deal concluded and one that's comprehensive.
What message about human rights will you be taking to the Chinese leaders?
Well, we always raise the issue of human rights, and it happens primarily between our embassies and, more often than not, the foreign minister. So, yep, we'll continue to raise those issues that, you know, New Zealand, you know, takes human rights abuses seriously, that we want to see an improvement in human rights right around the world, not specific to China, and any particular concerns we have we'll raise with them. But it's not going to be the number one issue in terms of my meetings with the president, not because it's not important, but because the vehicle we tend to use for raising those is typically through the foreign minister. But in the course of conversations it may come up, and if it does, I'll express that view.
And what will your message be about milk safety here?
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, I think the most important thing will be that New Zealand takes food safety standards, you know, very seriously. The Chinese know that, because one of the first things I did when I became Prime Minister in 2009 was set up a program to work with the Chinese on helping improve their food safety standards. I mean, in terms of DCD, which I guess is a top of mind issue, I think they accept that there are no food safety standard issues there. And, you know, they certainly understand that we invest a lot in making sure that we can track the quality of our food. So I'll be reaffirming that we are totally committed to that issue.
I just going back to TPP.
Yeah.
Will New Zealand actively push for the Japanese entry not to delay the timetable?
Well, there's a consultation process that takes place before their, as I understand, before their final acceptance into TPP, and we'll be spelling out the consistent case we do with everybody, which is, we kind of welcome people that want to come in. We would especially welcome Japan because they're a big economy and an important partner to New Zealand. But we highly value a comprehensive deal and one that's concluded as quickly as possible.
Does that mean you won't want them in unless they do agriculture?
Well, I've said before publicly, I can't see how, as Prime Minister of New Zealand, I can commit us to TPP if it didn't include agriculture. You know, I'd be a laughing stock within New Zealand, and I can't see why anyone would accept that. It's 73% of all of our exports in terms of food production. So a TPP that excludes agriculture is really a pretty toothless TPP from our perspective.
No, you wouldn't let Japan not include agriculture. I mean, I presume New Zealand's position is that it expects liberalisation, but it could give it a long lead in time.
Well, that's always been the case, that these things, there's never been an expectation that overnight there will be a complete phase out of tariffs and subsidies. There's always been an expectation there would be a period of phase out. That's normal with any FTA, because there's a period of adjustment that economies like Canada, which is highly subsidised and protected, would need to go through.
There must be a lead in timetable that you would rule out as a bit faster, probably.
Well, there'll be, in the end, there'll be, you know, we're going through whatever is round 16, I think, of negotiations, but at some point we're going to come down to a condensed set of issues that need thrashing out, if not amongst leaders, then amongst a small group of officials. And I expect there to be a wide range of dates and phase-out timetables put on the negotiating table. New Zealand will be arguing for the shortest, some will argue for the longest. Hopefully we'll meet somewhere in the middle.
So if the final draft of TPP doesn't include agriculture, will you pull out?
I would have thought so, yeah.